90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City, Community Radio. Streaming online at www.kkfi.org.
The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
Welcome to Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. Today we have Missouri State Representative Brandon Ellington, and we're going to be talking about the interesting 2018 legislative roundup. Good morning, Representative Ellington. Welcome to Cowtown Conversations.
Hey, how you doing today?
Not too bad. So this year, last time I had you on, it was the good, the bad, and the ugly, and everything turned out ugly. This year we have a lot of who shot John and why and what happened and where are we at now.
Yeah, you know, I started watching the real world probably back in the late 2000s, and I always wanted to live in a real world scenario after I watched Tech on that show. And I finally had my experience into reality. I want to say TV. Well, I guess it is TV because we went national this year. So I got my exposure to reality TV. Go now, Chloe.
Before we get to the good stuff, what committees are you on this year?
This year I'm the ranking member of Ways and Means. I'm on Homeland Security, and I'm also on Urban Issues.
Okay. So we have to start with the question that everybody wants to know. Governor Greitens' decision to step down. He said vehemently he was going to fight it to the end. He was not going to step down. In your opinion, what led to his decision out of the month him saying that he would not step down?
Well, in my opinion, I think you've seen big money do what big money does. So the governor had multiple felony charges put against him this year. One of them would deal with sexual misconduct of a woman when it came to the photo, the threat of disseminating the photo. It was a couple misdemeanors and felonies when it came to the charity list that he took, and none of these felonies or misdemeanors or accusations or people calling him for him to resign or anything had any effect on him until the dark money was about to be disclosed in a court case. And all of a sudden he turned 360 degrees and he said that he was going to resign. I think it was directly related to the revealing of those donors that has been donating to him, because the court case would have actually pulled that out. It would have made it permissible underneath the courts for people to be able to view, which is not permissible right now the way campaign finance money is able to be hid. So I think that's simple and plain. It was the money.
So this was the governor who said he was going to run on reform and that he was going to get rid of the dark money, but in the end it was dark money that took him down.
Well, I would actually say he did his job, because by resigning he got rid of the dark money and he actually cleaned up Jeff City, because before he got there we didn't have governors that was accused of tying women up, taking nude photos of them, and them threatening to release those photos, which would be blackmail, which is a felony.
Representative Ellington, you were very vocal when the scandal with Governor Greitens began, and you said he needed to step down then. Why were you so vocal with that?
Because I thought it was the right thing. When it comes to extramarital affairs, I typically don't get involved in those or anything like that, but when it comes to allegations of sexual abuse and rape, and you're the governor of the state, it's going to be almost impossible to govern. And that's what we've seen this year. He got not charged, but the allegations first came out on Inauguration Day. So the day he was getting sworn in, it came out during the State of the State. So an hour before he did the State of the State, the rumor was out that the news report was going to break. After he did the State of the State, the news report broke when it came to the sexual allegations of the young lady. And again, in January, if you have sexual allegations of rape and you're the governor, it's almost impossible to have a moralistic stick. And that's what we've seen this year. This year, we've seen the legislative body completely clogged up until around the last month or so, when the writing was starting to come on the wall of what was going to happen. The Greitens and the Republican Party figured out where they wanted to be united at. But we pretty much became a national laughingstock, and it was all due to our governor's refusal to do what was right.
So this was to say it was a distraction during the legislative session would be putting it mildly, then it was more like the elephant in the room that everybody was trying to figure out how to get the elephant out of the room.
No, yes, yes, definitely. It was a Kim Jong-il of Missouri with his fingers on the button playing with Trump. So that's what we, that's pretty much the scenario we had, complete chaos at the Capitol.
So now we have a new lieutenant governor stepped up to be Governor Mike Parsons. But then on the flip side of that, the Missouri Constitution is vague about how to fill the vacancy. So the governor appointed his own lieutenant governor. Should it have been something that should have been on the ballot this November?
No, I'm actually extremely glad that you mentioned that. So this is some of the discussions that we've actually been having in the Democratic caucus. And I was actually shocked to get the text message. I believe it was yesterday I got it, to get the text message from my chief of staff that they've already filled the lieutenant governor's position. And again, like you stated, there is no direct dissemination of how to do it in the Constitution. However, it's elected position. It's not an appointed position. So I'm actually surprised that the governor, or the new governor, went ahead and appointed somebody, and I would be extremely upset if the Democrats didn't challenge it. Because if we don't challenge it, he will become the sitting, well, he is the sitting lieutenant governor right now, but he will be solidified as a lieutenant governor doing business as usual as a lieutenant governor. And I feel that the Democratic Party has to put a challenge in, because I don't feel it's right. It's an elected position. You don't just fill any other elected positions, example. So if I'm the state representative of the 22nd district. So let's say something happened where I had to resign or I wasn't able to fulfill my duties in office. The governor could not appoint a representative to that seat, right? He can appoint a special election where somebody could be elected for that position, and that's what I feel would have been the proper procedure for the succession of the lieutenant governor seat.
So now we have the lieutenant governor appointed by the governor, and now we have the Democratic court case that says that he shouldn't be appointed lieutenant governor. So now we're going to still be in the media spotlight and hang out a few more months until the situation gets resolved.
But at least this one is a little bit better. So for the last 4 or 5 months, the atmosphere and the optics of Missouri is that we was a third world state. I mean, I got people outside of the state asking me, how do y'all have a governor that has multiple felony charges against him and nobody's saying nothing? How do you have a governor that shows up and people show up to the rally and he's accused of pretty much raping a woman and denying it across the board? Because he never denied he took the picture. He just said it is no picture. And these are things that has been blacklisting the state. So at least in this case, it's a debate about ideals, a debate about the proper process. Even though I feel that the Republicans are abusing their power and abusing the governorship by appointing a lieutenant governor, at least the conversation in this case scenario has to do with facts and not rape, abuse, misconduct, or anything. Well, I guess it could be misconduct depending on how the court rules. So let me stop there.
So in Missouri, we vote on the governor and lieutenant governor separately. Should we change that? And also that part of the state constitution to where they voted on both and then clean up this point of what happens if we need to have a succession?
I think we do need to put some language in there to codify what actually happens when it comes to succession time, not necessarily the separation of the votes. I think it's beneficial to have the potential of having separate parties in the offices. So, example, when Nixon was governor, we had a Republican, Kinder, that was the lieutenant governor. Right. So the lieutenant governor doesn't have as heavy of a workload as the governor in any way, shape, form or fashion. But at least it gives the appearance of a democratic system where you have opposition in leadership positions. So I would prefer the process that we have now where separate votes. However, appointed elected positions should never happen. And it does need to be cleaned up in the Constitution. For whatever reason, I don't think they foresaw a governor just appointing a lieutenant governor. Don't know why they didn't foresee that, but it does need to be cleaned up. And this is something that should not happen because you don't have this in any other caveat of elected positions. Now, when you talk about directors and different positions of appointments, yes, it's customary to appoint somebody to that seat once that seat is vacated. But an elected position, that's uncustomary and it's extremely dangerous.
So was the impeachment of Governor Greitens inevitable in just a matter of days if the documents had been turned over from the dark money?
The impeachment process was a joke. So this is one of the I have very few votes that I regret since I've been in office because I always vote out of my heart. Every once in a while, I make a vote that I distaste, and the vote that I dislike was the vote to convene the commission to investigate the governor. Now, I took the vote because obviously everybody in the state, especially in my district, was questioning why is the governor sitting in office, et cetera. I was one of the first, if not the first, I believe I was the first Democrat to call for him to resign. So I was extremely vocal about him being removed from office. But the commission, I believe, created a cover. And that goes to the heart of your question about the impeachment process. I think if we had went through the impeachment process, the governor probably would have remained unimpeached. And I say this because of the time frame in which the Republicans have actually created underneath the commission during session. So the first accusation came out in January around the State of the State, sometime around January the 20th or 19th. I can't remember what date the State of the State was. It took until around the beginning of April to actually have a committee that was to investigate the governor. And some of the flaws in this committee that I've seen was in a court scenario, you have rules of evidence, right? So certain things that can be transmitted, certain things that can't be transmitted, the same when it comes to empirical facts, et cetera. So in the commission, none of that exists. Let me try to get the listeners a clear example. In the court of law, you won't have witness A testifying while witness B is sitting in the audience. Well, in this case scenario, it wasn't the same rules of separation or anything like that. And the other thing would be the rule and the fact finding and also the authority of the committee. Because as we've seen, once the committee put in requests for the governor to come and talk, he denied it because he had no legal authority to come in there and talk to the committee. I felt the committee was a shell game. And the last thing I would like to say about it, unless you have any questions, is immediately upon his resignation, the committee decided to dissolve. Well, if it was about fact-finding, you don't quit once the wolf leaves the hen house. You figure out which hen he ate, where the feather and the blood is at, right? So when it came to this case scenario, they immediately dissolved with no recommendation of any type of action to be taken by anybody. Now, remember, in the committee, they was going not only through the sexual allegations, they was also going through the dark money allegations, which would have further implications and strings associated to other people that's in office, around Jeff City, lobbying, etc. All of this disappeared. And again, I'm upset that I took the vote because I should have stood as a protest vote against what I thought was a political procedure. And we've seen the outcome of it, that it was nothing but a political procedure. And it was a unanimous vote. Everybody in the House said we need to investigate him. But I had a feeling that the investigation was a shell game to give him more time, and that's what it did.
So to put it in layman's terms, they were having the witnesses, all the witnesses in the courtroom at the same time. So witness B could be influenced by the testimony of witness A.
Yeah.
And, but.
Now let's take it a step further. So let's say I'm the defense attorney, and I'm sitting in there. and I'm listening to all of this go on. Well, now I come back to court and I say the evidence has been tainted. Now, we've seen something similar in the Bob McCullough case when it came to Mike Brown. So what happened in the Bob McCullough case and the similarities that I'm talking about is when the grand jury indictment, Prosecutor McCullough, he released all evidence. He released factual evidence and non-factual evidence, which tainted the potential jury pool in the future. What's the same thing when you have the House conducting a criminal style investigation at the exact same time a criminal prosecution is going on? So you have the same evidence that's being talked about in court that's being talked about in the public without the same purview of regulation. The same when it comes to witnesses that are coming in to testify. You may have witnesses that come in front of the House that would never make it in front of the court because of the, you know, the strikes and balances and all that good stuff. So this was an extremely dangerous, what's the word I want to use? This is an extremely dangerous experiment in quasi-political, I can't think of the word.
Quasi-political politics at this point.
Yeah, I just leave it there.
So do you think Governor Greitens should have been able to cut a deal with the St. Louis prosecutor on the Charlotte charges? That was quick before I got the question out.
No, and this one actually hurts me because the circuit attorney in St. Louis City, I have nothing but respect for Ms. Gardner. When she served in the House of Representatives, we was pretty much yin and yang on the floor when it came to criminal justice bills or education bills or any bills that deal with social de-escalation of institutions that create barriers, etc. I don't know the details of the deal because obviously they can't give the details of the deal. I don't feel that a deal should have been cut for the simple basis of if he did A, B, C, D, E, F, and G of all of these allegations that he's been accused of, he should have the same suffer the same criminal justice system that I would have to suffer. In particular, when we talk about the difference between so-called minority representatives when they're caught up in legal issues and non-so-called minority, we see a drastic imbalance. So for all of these reasons, I felt that the prosecution should have stood tough and went ahead. Now, being honest and speaking honestly, I understand why. So the St. Louis circuit attorney was getting all type of death threats and all of these things from the moment that she filed, but the death threats wouldn't have been what pushed the envelope. She showed courage by going out there, governor, doing what our attorney general was too scared to do and punted the puck to her. It was also a setup with the time frame, and I can get more in detail with this if you want to, from the time frame that the attorney general turned over the evidence to the circuit attorney in St. Louis and the time frame in which she had to file both felony charges. It wasn't that big of a
window.
Yeah, not at all. And then you also had national money coming against. And I say this because Greitens is from Missouri. But if anybody actually studied Eric Greitens, Eric Greitens, you will see that most of his influence was national influence. Most of his dollars and donors came from outside of the state. So it was a lot of money involved in this court case. It was a lot of money involved around keeping Eric Greitens in office because he was already slated to be one of the next presidential contenders, and that was before he served day one and the governorship. And depending on where we go in the conversation, I don't have any problem going any deeper to open it up for listeners out there.
So do you think that this deal was a part of his resignation agreement?
Yes, it definitely was. So the deal had everything to do with him not going to jail. It was also a disclosure in there in which he could not talk. But yes, this is the reason why he resigned. He cut a deal for illegal stuff that, in my opinion, he cut a deal for illegal stuff that he did, and then he jumped on a horse like Butch Cassidy and rode out.
And so then his lawyers sent their bills, which was $150,000 to the state, and wanted the state to pay for the bills. Should we have paid for the bills, or should the governor pay for his bills?
All right, now this is one of the ones I actually don't have a solid answer for. So, being facetious, I would like to say, no, this is your bill, this is what you acquired, etc. But the legal question comes in about, he was the governor when he had the legal team up underneath him, and it was no challenge when he was the governor. So I give kudos to the Office of Administration for actually coming out saying, hey, we're not going to pay this. I give kudos to them for real, because the director and all of them had to come in underneath Grayson, because they reformat all department directors, things of that nature. Personally, I don't feel that we should pay for it, but legally, I think we may actually be on the hook for it, because he was the governor when he acquired a legal team and it was no challenge.
Well, right now they said, no, they're not going to pay for it, so we may end up in court again behind something with the governor.
And you know what? I want to throw this in, too. This is another issue that I had with the commission that was convened. So the same governors, the same counselor that was working for the Republicans is working for the Democrats. So whose natural interest is at hand? Because what I've seen is that the preservation of the institution was more important than any type of legal justification or ramifications of what happened.
So this one, I know people, this is straight out of fantasy here. How ironic is the Governor Grayson signed 77 bills on his final day in office, and one of the bills was the law that made it a felony to threaten to disseminate or distribute a sexually explicit image taken without consent.
Well, again, according to the governor, He didn't take a picture without consent. He don't know where the picture is at, but it was extremely ironic. So, Representative Jim Nidley was actually the sponsor of the bill. I was a co-sponsor of the bill. I actually made that a comment similar to what you said on the floor. I was like, something similar to, you know, I'm glad we can all unite past the, anti-Grayson bill, something like that I said. And I literally made every Republican mad, man. I had so many Republicans coming over to him like, Ellington, man, come on, man. You can't ask me anything like that. I'm voting for the bill. So it was extremely ironic. We had bipartisan support on the bill. It wouldn't make what the governor did explicit illegal crime. In the governor's case, the photo would not have actually been the crime. The dissemination of the photo or the transferring of the photo would have been the actual crime in the governor's case. And that was one of the legal loopholes that the governor was playing, because it wasn't that if I took the picture, it's if I actually disseminated the picture. And that's why he kept saying, I have no picture. He never once stated that he didn't take the picture.
The picture had ended up being transmitted, then it would have been a different issue. Mm-hmm. It was all about the transmission of the photo, not him taking the photo.
Yep, and that's actually what the circuit attorney in St. Louis City was prosecuting him on, and then they had another charge associated with the assault that they was about to prosecute him on before the deal to resign, be quiet, and keep the dark money in the dark.
So essentially, this bill closes the loophole that the governor was using to keep himself out of jail. Well, I won't say jail, but out of trouble.
Yes and no. Because the governor was hinging on the transmittal of the photo. Yes, on the taking of the photo, 100%, but the transmittal would still be a separate associated felony.
Okay. So if you have any questions for Representative Ellington about this year's legislative session, give us a call on the studio line, 816-931-5534. That's 816-931-KKFI. Of the 144 bills there were 144 bills signed this year during the session, and Governor Grayson signed half of those on his final day. Is there any possibility that those bills may be overturned during the veto session?
Now, see, this is my fear of the new governor. No. And no, the reason I gave you two no's, we have until August the 28th to receive the total of list of bills that the governor signs. After that, bills will go into law after like 30 days if they're not vetoed. With Parsons, I have a feeling that a lot of the Republican agenda that was actually stalled this year because of the Grayson's issue and the lack there of unity on the Republican Party between who was going to benefit and who was going to lose out and all this other crazy stuff that goes on. I fear that he's going to sign bills that would have died, to answer the question. I don't think we're going to see a overturning of bills. I think we will see an increase in the Republican production of legislation. especially going into next year. So again, for those that have listened or just called in, from January until around April, it was pretty much nothing going on. I'm going to give you an example. So I went to the chair of Crime Prevention Committee, Representative Roden. And I had a bill in this committee, and I was like, hey, man, I haven't had no hearing on this bill. I need to get this bill moving, blase, blase. He looked me dead in my eye. He was like, Ellington, man, I apologize. I haven't had a hearing in over a month. And I looked at him. I'm like, what do you mean? Like, over a month? He's like, yeah, man, I can't get a hearing. So it was nothing moving. So he wasn't sitting on my bill. He wasn't trying to deny representation of the 22nd district or anything like that. He actually liked the bill. He was like, I just can't do anything because I haven't had a hearing. I haven't got a notice for one, right? So this is a part of the dysfunctionality that was actually occurring this year when it came from the Republican regime. And underneath Parsons, you were about to have a united Republican front. For those that are unaware about his political prowess, he's liked in the Senate. Right. So you taking somebody that was disliked by both parties, Greitens. He was disliked by the Democrats. He was disliked by the Republicans because of the comments that he would make about the Republicans and politicians and all the evil stuff that they do that he got caught doing. Right. To somebody that's unanimously liked by Democrats in the House and in the Senate. I'm extremely fearful for what I see coming to Missouri, because since I've been in the House for the first 4 years at least, I was blessed to be able to serve up underneath the Democratic governor. Even though people may have said he was not a true Democrat, I knew it was bills that was never going to become law because he was there. Right. I knew right to work was never going to get signed. I knew paycheck perception or deception or protection or whatever catchphrase they want to give to it was never going to get signed. I knew that certain union busting bills was never going to get signed. I knew certain social service cutting bills would never get signed. Well, now I fear that all of those is going to be signed with a smiley face at the end.
And you have a former lieutenant governor who was a elected sheriff.
Yes.
He was a member of the Missouri State Senate, so he knows where Greitens was first time elected, didn't know how things worked. So now you have a governor who knows how things work, knows how to get the bills passed, and know what things you need to do.
Oh, man, it's about to be scary, because you have a body that has an appetite of accelerating and want to get things done. So like with the Republican regime, the one thing that I credit and I give them is a lot of their hot item agenda items they get, and they've been getting these last couple of years. I don't necessarily agree with them, but one and one is two, and I call it like I see it. This is really fading in and out, so I may not be able to hear the caller.
Caller, we've got a caller. Can you tell us your name and where you're calling from?
Yes, this is Daniel from Grandview. Hello, Brandon.
Hey, how you doing today?
We did those social versus capitalistic talks on the radio some time ago.
Yeah, man, how you been?
Oh, hanging in there, having a good time and all this and that.
What's your question for Representative Ellington?
Well, I was just wondering about the marijuana issue, if it's being addressed at all, if it's moving forward, if it can, what the issue or the status of it. I know you're for it. And I was just wondering what's going on about it.
Oh, okay. I'm about to make you extremely mad. So we had a bill this year, Representative Jim Neely bill again, and it was a watered-down, municipal bill. But the reason I said it's going to make you mad, we actually had the House vote yes on it and the Senate vote yes on it, only to get it pushed out in the conference committee. And one of the senators that had an issue with it, or at least questioned it in the conference committee, was Senator Holzman, which pretty much killed the bill. Now, the reason I said it was going to make you mad, for those that have been following the legalization of marijuana in Missouri, they understand that the legislative body has been extremely fearful to take votes on it, to bring it to the floor, to even move it in committee. And we had a bill that went from patients that was dying to open it up across the board to glaucoma, patients with nervous issues, et cetera, which would have been a huge step in Missouri for total legalization, because we had to actually open it up to all type of medical issues. It's an initiative petition that's on the ballot that's going forward this year. I'm actually opposed to all the initiative petitions because of the regulations and the requirements. So one of the differences in the bill that would have been positive coming out of the body this year, it had no restrictions on growing, right? So if somebody wanted to grow, they could just grow. It actually opened up the door for that, which is different in certain legalization states when you have dispensaries and you have restrictions on what you can grow and what you can't grow. So even though it had been limited to medical usage, buying in pharmacies, et cetera, they had a provision in there that would allow folks to grow their own if they so chose to. So I do feel that the body is actually changing. I don't know where the new governor is on it, actually, because I've never sat down and talked to persons about it. If the ballot initiative doesn't get on, though, I think we will see something from the state of Missouri. My fear from the state of Missouri, though, is the regulations. And just to highlight a bill that I have out there, I have a bill that would copy the Washington, D.C. law. And if we actually copy that Washington, D.C. law, it is no regulations when it comes to dispensary. It is no medical or recreational confusion. It is that you can grow, you can produce, you can gift. Right. So in Washington, D.C., if you go to a gas station and they want to give you a gift of whatever with your purchase, they can do that. Or if they wanted to go to what would be considered a dispensary and you want to buy a normal item like a hat, a T-shirt, etc., they can gift it to you, which gets you out of the federal regulation since the feds have not deregulated or descheduled it. So we will have movement in Missouri. Everything is dead this year. The bill that had the most potential did pass out of the House and pass out of the Senate, but it got pulled out of the conference committee, and the conference committee is something that comes about after both chambers have passed a piece of legislation and it's an issue with it.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for your expertise. I appreciate it.
Oh, man, I'll try to hit you with everything real quick.
Thank you for calling. We're going to have to take a short break, but we'll be right back. You're listening to Cowtown Conversations. This is your host, Joseph Jackson. Today we're talking with Representative State Legislator Brandon Ellington from the 22nd District, and we'll be right back after this short break. And we're back. This is Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. And Representative Ellington, as Kava just talked about, the state has legalized the oil portion of it, but then Kansas City went a little bit further and they decriminalized up to 35 grams of marijuana. We've got mixed signals here. What's the issue?
Oh man, all kind of mixed signals and confusion. So first and foremost, let me put my disclaimer out. The ordinance that the city of Kansas City passed last year, the year before that, I was 100% against that ordinance. Completely against that ordinance. Came out and try to be as vocal as I could be about that ordinance. Because what that ordinance does is it requires people to sign, if they so choose to the knowledge that they've just committed an illegal act, right, by having possessing up to an ounce and a little bit over of marijuana in the state of, in the city of Kansas City. The state law already made it a misdemeanor for 28 grams, right, which is an ounce of marijuana. So in one case scenario, you have what couldn't have been any more than a misdemeanor, and now that you're actually signing to what could be a felony issue, right? And I say the difference because once I admit to an illegal act, that goes into all type of federal resources that I'm denied.
Exactly. Student loans,
yeah.
Federal
yeah.
financial aid, all yeah. these different things. But now the state decriminalized 28 grams, but the city went further and tried to decriminalize 35 grams. Where's the
this is the misunderstanding or bad political axis of folks in office. So if it was misunderstanding of the law, that's something that could almost be accounted for, but you need to know what you're doing and you need to know your job, right? If it's bad political acting, then everybody should be moralistically shamed and removed from office. And I say both of these just hitting people with the law. State law is always, Like, we changed it underneath the criminal code, but it was already 28 grams, right? It was already up to a zip that you could have, and it would be pretty much a misdemeanor, and we gave cities discretion, right? That was the only difference. The city law requires somebody to admit to a felony act. So one signal is confusing in the city of Kansas City, because do we want people to have a misdemeanor, or do we want people to be denied from future federal access? And that's the message that the city of Kansas City is putting out. The state has always been clear. Either you can have this amount and it can be hit with a misdemeanor or not. We didn't send no change in the message. And when you go to the oil was a CDBG, which we passed a couple years ago, which showed a small sentiment of changing. I think one of the most hesitations with the state is the federal complications when it comes to banking, financing, and what you actually do to your dollars. Not necessarily the confusion of if we want people to be felons or if we want people to have misdemeanor charges on them, right? And a lot of people may call in and they say, well, you know, I got arrested with such and such amount and I got A, B, and Z. Well, I ask you if you actually took it to court or did you take a deal? Because if you take a plea deal, you can get hit with anything underneath the spectrum.
So we've got a caller. Caller, can you tell us your name and where you're calling from, your question for Representative Ellington? Hello? Caller? Hello?
Hello?
Hello, yes. Can you tell us your name and where you're calling from and what your question is to Representative Ellington?
Good morning. Yeah, this is Mickey Dean. Brandon, how you doing?
Hey, how you doing?
Okay, and first of all, I appreciate all the work you do. But here's my question. I have some concern about money bail because of the fact that poor people are locked up and they stay locked up because they can't post bail. To address that, is that a state issue at all, or is that purely a local issue?
Nah, it's state. We call that it could be local too, but it's definitely state. We call that debtor's prison. So the circuit attorney in St. Louis, former Representative Kim Gordon, when she was in office, that's something that we really worked on. She gave me a couple ideas for some legislation that I'll be filing again this year for her. But that's something that definitely needs to be addressed. It's something that the city of St. Louis, underneath the circuit attorney's office, is actually addressing. They're doing it somewhat with marijuana too. But that's something that we definitely need to address, and it's one of the reasons that we have been looking at a lot of municipal issues. So Senate Bill 5 that we passed about 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, went to the heart of the taxation by citation that we found a lot of cities, smaller municipalities, and particularly in St. Louis and some of the facilities in between Kansas City and St. Louis was practicing. In the state of Missouri, we know that the numbers for African Americans that get pulled over is somewhere up to 86%, something like that, extremely high. Most of these fall into what you're talking about, debtor's prison, where people get fined, go to jail for things that they can't pay. So this is something that we're aware of. It's something that I'm definitely working on. It's actually something that I can feel confident in saying that Republicans are actually sensitive to, too. So a lot of Republicans that we've talked about, that they understand the issue, so hopefully we will see some type of significant legislation on it.
Okay, appreciate that, and I'm very interested in helping out on that, so you can always let me know if something we can do out here.
And I'm going to be reaching out to you. So I got a new chief of staff, Patrick. Lucy was she was probably the best assistant that I had, but Patrick, he's more political, so we've been putting together political packs and who we can actually reach out to, so we will be reaching out to you.
Appreciate it, man.
Thank you for your call. We've got another call. Caller, can you tell us your name and where you're calling from and what your question is for Representative Ellington? Hello? Caller, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes. Rich, can you tell us your question for Representative Ellington?
Yeah, I wanted to ask him about the preemption stuff that the state government seems to want to do every time the right wing doesn't like something that Kansas City does or St. Louis does, like minimum wage and like gun control. Can you talk about that problem of the... And Alec, can you talk about Alec?
Hey, I can hit you with all of that. To answer your first part of your question, I haven't been able to figure that out yet. So I talk to a lot of people on both sides of the aisle. So when I talk to the Republicans, that's one of the questions that I ask. And it's actually a Republican up there, Representative Shaw, who I call Obamacare every time I see him. And the reason I call him Obamacare is because they had huge issues with passing Medicaid expansion, et cetera. But he was the representative that filed the bill that would restrict cities having the ability to choose if they wanted paper or plastic bags. So when we talk about the state preemptively getting involved in local government, when a lot of my colleagues say that local representation is best and local power is best, I haven't been able to figure it out. But the minimum wage, that was actually the city of Kansas City playing with you guys. And the reason I say that, I've been in office since 2011. I've never once, not once, seen Kansas City lobbying team at the Capitol lobbying for increasing minimum wage. I've never once seen the mayor of the city of Kansas City, Mayor Sly James, come up to the Capitol and lobby anybody about increasing the minimum wage. I've never seen any of the council people, right, the in-district or at large, in any of the districts, any of the six districts, at all, ever come up to the state and inquire about increasing the minimum wage. Nor have I ever seen the city, and this is something people need to pay attention to, because around April, the city of Kansas City, they put out their list of city priorities that they're actually going to talk about the state. They do a whole meeting on it on Channel 2. I've never once seen a transcript, heard a conversation, or anything from them about putting an increase on the minimum wage on the agenda. So I've been extremely upset by the city, by playing with people. Since 2012, I've consistently filed minimum wage increase bills. Never once had the city of Kansas City support it. I said all this to say this. The city of Kansas City knew what the state law was, because the city of St. Louis had tried it 3 or 4 years prior, and it got denied. And they went to the Supreme Court, and they lost that case. And then the city of Kansas City said they was going to do what was already being done without trying to do it at the state level, which they already know. And remember, our mayor is a lawyer. Our at-large third district representative is a lawyer. Our fifth district in-district representative is a lawyer. So they got enough attorneys on there to be able to figure out what they can and what they can't do. So the minimum wage, that was political prostitution. They was playing with folks. The preemptive nature of the state, I haven't been able to figure out, because on one end, the Republicans talk all this local control and how government intrusion is bad, and then everything they dislike, they do intrude on. I haven't been able to figure that out at all, man. Because we do that consistently. The other issue he had was Alex, which is American Legislative Exchange Council. This is where 99.9% of your Republican legislation is being filed in the House of Representatives comes from, right? And this is not my opinion. You can throw a rock at any bill, pull it up, and then put that language in Google, and you'll find another bill in like Alabama or one of the states around us. So when it comes to our gun laws, these have all been Alex bills. So the gun everywhere, the deregulation of the guns, the constitutional carry, all Alex. When it comes to the deregulation and defunding of education, all Alex. When it comes to, and I'm going to forget the Senate bill, but when it comes to certain Senate bills that deal with changing venue, changing venue will go to where you can actually file a case, et cetera, when it's almost all of these is Alex. So the American Legislative Exchange Council is a group of conglomerate of Fortune 500 companies that come together. And they pretty much write legislation for legislators, and these legislators file these pieces of legislation without knowing the effects. We had a representative this year on the floor that had a bill dealing with TANF. When we got up, and this debate went on for about 2 or 3 hours, as we're debating her and we're asking her questions, it was not one question that she can answer. And this is Representative Kelly. You can pull up the transcripts from the House archives, the House Journal, and you will see 2 hours of debates of deferred answers. I can't answer that. The co-sponsor is going to get up after I get finished. The co-sponsor, well, if you're the sponsor of the bill, why are you pointing at another representative to say, this bill came from Alex, which again is the American Legislative Exchange Council. And for those that are unaware of Alex, I suggest that y'all pull up the American Legislative Exchange Council and see why all of these bills is coming about. It's the reason why we have state convention bills being filed in all these states. It's the reason why we have all of these, stand your ground bill. Alex, I mean, there's so many bills I can go off of that directly came from the think tank. The circumventing or the consolidation of the minimum wage, Alex. Insurance bills, Alex. right? It's so many bills that's coming out that's hurting American people because we're not paying attention to the personhood of corporations, which was a Supreme Court case about 10 years ago.
It's a little bit back, yes, between 5 and 10 years ago.
Okay, yeah.
Well, that's terrific that you're interested in talking about it.
I mean, I have no problem with Alex. I actually, funny story. So they have Alex meetings up there at the around the Capitol every once in a while, right? So they had an Alex meeting last session. I walked up in that meeting, and I put this on anything. You could hear a pin drop. As I came up the stairs, I'm seeing heads turn, people getting, what you doing here? I want to see what y'all doing. I want to see what the presentation's about, right? So they do meetings all the time. They do events outside the state all the time where they bring legislators in. And this is pretty much where they're getting their MK Ultra. That's the sci-fi, the tinfoil hat. This is where they get their brainwashing things from right there, right? They go in there, they get their bills, and they come out, and they file these bills, and they have no idea the effects of these bills. And I've seen it since I've been there. Since I've been in the body, I can honestly say term limits is extremely negative because I've watched lobbyists carry bluebacks when we have bluebacks. And bluebacks would be the bill that you actually get other legislators to sign on. A lobbyist should never be carrying that. And then I watched the lobbyist go inside the room to file the bill. How is a lobbyist filing the bill when the only person that's supposed to file the bill is the legislator? Well, this is the type of political process that we have right now. It's all being controlled by what in Missouri we call dark money. And this directly goes back to the governor's case. Because, again, in the governor's case, you had a governor that said, hey, I don't care about being charged with rape. I don't care about being charged with stealing lists. I don't care about stealing from charity events. I don't care about calling senators dummies and all type of things like this. I don't care about none of these misdemeanors that you hit me with, none of these felonies that you hit me with. But you know the one thing I'm not going to do? Go ahead, Joe.
Not going to expose dark money.
Oh, not at all.
I'm going to make sure dark money stays in the closet where dark money should stay.
Which goes back to the caller in the Alex comment, because Alex, again, if these are Fortune 500 companies, these would be the same companies that donate to your legislators. These would be the same companies that benefit off of tax, the loss of taxation. Right? Meaning tax credits and different things that the government gives away to bring these companies in.
Well, you sure seem informed on that.
I got issues with Alex. Like, you opened up a can with them. Like.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to get off, but thank you very much.
Thank you for your call, Rich. So, as we begin to look at, piggyback a little bit what you were talking about. One thing that people may not know, in the state of Missouri, seatbelt law is a secondary law. Can you explain what a secondary law is for seatbelt?
Man, I'm so glad you hit me with this because this is something new. So a secondary law means it's not a primary offense. A primary offense would be a offense that you can actually be pulled over for. Now, any violation you can receive a ticket for, right? But that would be a secondary offense, not the primary offense to pull you over. A primary offense would be like a moving violation or a mechanical failure.
So how can the city call Missouri Highway Patrol in preparation for this? There are about 25 municipalities that have changed that, Kansas City being one of them, where they made not wearing your seatbelt a primary offense. So explain what that means to our listeners.
Yeah, this is something I'm actually going to have to pull up and research because I got hit on this today. But basically what that would mean, it would mean it's a offense that you can be pulled over for, which causes all type of questions and red flags in my mind because at the state, I know it's not a primary offense. I know it's a secondary offense. Now, in saying this, local municipalities can do things that are illegal until they're challenged, i.e. the traffic cameras, right? So the city of Kansas City, perfect example, was citing people for traffic camera violations after the state clearly said they couldn't do it. And then the state came out and we had to create a whole nother law to guarantee that folks wouldn't be violated by pulling up to the light because of violation of due process, which is constitutional protection, et cetera. So, when it comes to the state being able to, the city doing certain things, yes, that can happen. That can happen in any caveat of elected or political atmosphere until it's actually challenged. Once it's challenged, that's where you have a overturning of the law. And I'll give you an example because you mentioned guns. So at the, I'm going to make some people mad. Down at City Hall, you have a sign on the building that says no guns, right? Mm-hmm. But if you read the state law actually says you can carry guns in governmental buildings, Right. So if I went down to the, and I actually told Representative Nick Marshall, I'm embarrassing him now that I was going to do this, and I needed him to be with me because, you know, black folks, we get murdered on TV and nobody says anything. And Nick is a conservative, libertarian, Republican, so a white guy. So I asked him to come down with me. That way I'm at least have an objective viewpoint where they see him and they see me. But anyway, to get to the heart of the story, that's illegal. At the state of Missouri, if you come up to the Capitol, you know, where the governor's at and lieutenant governor's at and attorney general and all these folks, you can come in there, go through the metal detector, get your gun back. It's the same at the local level, right? Now, they have a sign on there, and they tell people they can't come in. And sure enough, if you walk in that door, they're going to arrest you. But if they do, they just violated your constitutional rights in the state of Missouri because we changed the law, right? So, a court challenge always has to be given. I don't know the details of the city ordinance to actually be able to break down the city ordinance yet, but that's something I am going to research. But a primary offense is the only offense that you're able to be pulled over for. Secondary offense is a ticketable offense, but not a offense that you could be able to be pulled over for. But again, the city does things that doesn't make sense, i.e. the minimum wage, when we knew what the state law was, we were going to do a whole campaign down here that has nothing to do with changing the law at the state, was something that we already know the answer to.
Well, I know we'll probably have to end on this one. The city ordinance is 70856D, which in the city's ordinance, and looking up for the show, it says that the fine is $10, which is what the state fine is. But I talked to somebody who got the ticket for that, and they said, well, I got a ticket for $15.
No, they can't do that.
And I said, well, and I was kind of said, you know, I'm going to have the representative on in a couple of days. We'll ask. I said, so the city is then turning around violating its own ordinance.
Yes.
But they're also violating state ordinance. It says that the maximum ticket amount, fine from that, is $10. But it takes somebody standing up to a charge and say that this is wrong. You know, you're going to have to go to court, have your day in court, and, you know, first, it's a secondary offense, so you're trumping state law. But then after that, now you're charging more than you're charging your own ordinance. So it's like, okay, how's this ticket even valid at this point?
I don't think it will be. Like, it's the same with the traffic lights. So with the traffic lights, they was giving people tickets. People were showing up to court. And people that was astute with the law, they was getting out of it. Other folks was paying the fines until we came back and we changed the law again. Like, look, dude, the law already said you couldn't do it. So then we reinforced it or refortified it. And it'd be the same with what you're talking about. What I like to give the listeners is, I don't care what form of government it is. I don't care if it's the federal, if it's the state, if it's the local. We all have regulations, right? We can break our own regulations, but if we break our regulations, There's a regulatory body beyond that. So if the state breaks its regulations, you have the federal government. This is why you have the supremacy clause, and it's the same with the cities. When the cities get out of the hand, you have the state to check them. So we have a semblance of control if we're willing, like you said, to be non-fearful and to stand up and to fight it. And I suggest anybody fights any abuse of the law, regardless if it's $10 or $15, and just to answer your question, they can't supersede the state. So state, like the feds, but the state carves out the rules of engagement in the cities. Once we carve out the rules of engagement, the cities can do what they want to do. I give you something simple. In the state of Colorado, marijuana is legal. So the cities cannot carve out regulations that makes it illegal. They may be able to designate zones in which you can't participate, but they can't make it legal. In the state of Missouri, it's illegal. So the cities can come up with offenses that falls up underneath that regulatory body. If we was to legalize it, they could not do anything. It'd be the same when we talk about guns. Right. So in the state of Missouri, we said guns is good for everybody. If you read the CCW statute, you will go through all about 10 or 13 facilities in which you cannot have a gun. Churches, schools, buses, all this good stuff. And then when you get down to the end of it, it's a paragraph that says, with the exception of a CCW, if you have your CCW, it is not legal to carry on these premises. The first offense would be you would be asked removed. So let's say I go into church and I have my AK 47 on me, and the pastor says I can't have it in there. Well, legally, I haven't broken any law. You can just ask me to leave because it's a private facility. And if I refuse to leave, then you can hit me with trespassing. But you can't hit me with anything illegal. The same with the city of Kansas City. It's a governmental building, and that's in that same statute.
We always love having Representative Ellington on, and the time goes fast. We're going to have you back pretty soon.
Anytime.
We're getting ready to do that. We never encounter time conversations without a community minute. And the one thing I want to say is that Ivanhoe has a farmer's market every Saturday. All the vegetables are pesticide-free, and they're also a double-buck SNAP provider, so purchases made up to $25 be doubled. For more information, you can go to the farmer's market every Saturday from 9 to noon right there at Linwood and Woodland. New thing in Missouri, we didn't get a chance to talk about it. You can now register to vote online in Missouri. Go to Kansas City Election Board, kceb.org, and click on Learn More to vote online. If you have a desktop computer, you can get the desktop option, but they're using right now cell phones, tablets, and touch screens. So to learn more, give the election board a call at 816-842-4820. And Cornerstones of Care is starting a relationship class the first Wednesday in July. So those that are interested, give Cornerstones of Care a call at 816-842-8200. So for CalTown Conversations, I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. Tune in next week, and we're going to talk about the dangers of celebratory gunfire with the Kansas City Police Department and a mother of a child who was killed on 4th of July. So tune in next week to learn more about the dangers of celebratory gunfire. For CalTown Conversations, I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. Have a great day, and stay tuned for My Place with Larry J.